Live from the College of Communication, Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University, it is now time to go beyond the X's and the O's with WKAR's current sports.
You want to go after an athlete, one of my athletes, come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40.
My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a star receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get.
Yes, did I express to them I was mad? I was furious. Just furious.
I know my wife will at least shut fake one time.
We talking about practice, not a game.
And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cat.
Here's your host, L. Martin.
What's up, current sports listeners? This is Ian Hawley filling in again for Al Martin on this Thursday, July 5th. Hope you all had a fantastic 4th of July holiday, and I hope you all stayed safe. Celebrating America's birthday, a.k.a. independence from Britain. It's been 242 long years in this country, and we've made a lot of progress as far as liberty and freedoms go in this country. But we should also take the time to remember that we still have a lot of work to do in this country, especially when it comes to civil rights, as far as some groups are concerned. Anyway, moving on, we got a lot of sports talk here for you today. I'll be talking about Michigan State football, to the upcoming season, and what we should expect from this year's Spartan team. We'll also be talking about a controversy in the NHL that's actually gained a lot of traction here in the past few weeks, in regards to a player named Slava Voynov, who was a member of the Los Angeles Kings back in 2014. He was a defenseman, but he had an assault charge, a domestic assault charge against him that actually caused him to serve some jail time and leave the NHL. But now Voynov wants to make a return, and the surprising part about this story is that there are a lot of NHL teams who have shown interest in him. So I'll give you the details on his arrest, and I'll give you my thoughts on the NHL and his return. We'll also talk a little bit more about LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers. Surprise, surprise. It's the summertime. Not a lot going on besides baseball. So we'll talk a little bit more about LeBron James and what it's going to take for this Los Angeles Lakers team to win an NBA championship. I actually read a story earlier today from ESPN by Ramona Shelburne and Brian Windhorst, a.k.a. the LeBron Whisperer. And it kind of changed my thoughts a little bit on where the Lakers stand right now. I still don't think they're title ready, but I don't think they're in as bad of a position as I may have stated on Tuesday. So I'll give you my thoughts on that as well. We'll also take a look back at today's famous occurrences on the date July 5th throughout sports history in our segment Throwback Thursday. All that and so much more. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you know what to do. Our number is 517-355-WKAR. That's 517-355-9527. You can tweet me directly at Ian Hawley WKAR, and I'll do my best to respond to your comments. My live stream is up and running at Facebook.com. You can find it on my profile, and hopefully we'll be able to share it on the WKAR sports page today as well. So you can leave your comments there, and either myself or our engineer for the day, Jack Kerwin, who's filling in at my usual spot, we'll take a look at those and we'll do our best to respond. And if you'd like to listen on our normal stations, that's AM 870 and 101.5 FM in the Lansing area. Got a lot to talk about today, but you know what's first. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners. We'll be right back. All right, we'll start with MSU football. When 2019 three-star quarterback Sam Saxton from St. Michael's Catholic Academy in Austin, Texas, glanced at his Twitter one June afternoon, he noticed a new group of followers, including Michigan State coaches. Saxton received a message from Sheldon White, Michigan State's executive director of player personnel and recruiting, and shortly later he was on the phone with quarterbacks coach Brad Salem. The initial contact between Saxton and the program came on June 24th, the same day that Oak Park 2019 four-star quarterback Juwan Mathis flipped his commitment from Michigan State to Ohio State. The Spartans are now in the market for a new quarterback, and Saxton is the one they're gunning for. This is coming from Saxton. He said, quote, "I think they're very interested in me. They think I have all the ability and components that can make a great Michigan State quarterback." Now, the Spartans have not officially offered him a scholarship yet, but Michigan State typically takes one quarterback in each class, and 2014 was the last cycle it didn't sign anyone at the position. That was the result of a late decommitment from Ohio three-star prospect Chris Durkin, who ultimately signed with the Virginia Tech Hokies. According to 247 Sports, Michigan State has only offered a trio of 2019 quarterbacks, and all three are committed elsewhere. Mathis' flip to Ohio State leaves the Spartans reevaluating prospects in that class. This is coming from Alan True, Midwest recruiting analysis for 247 Sports. He says, quote, "I think this staff, I've never known them to reach. So if they can't find a kid that fits the mold, I don't think they'll just take one just to take one. But I think you'd like to have a quarterback in every class. I think the plan is to go through and evaluate and see if they can find one that fits with them, that also likes them in turn. It looks like they're going through that process right now. I don't think they're going to rush it," end quote. So Sam Saxton, the latest quarterback target for the Michigan State Spartans for 2019. Michigan football has added yet another verbal commitment this past Tuesday as Washington, D.C., St. John's College 2019 three-star safety Quentin Johnson committed to Michigan over Alabama and Penn State, among others. Johnson gives the Wolverines their 19th verbal commit of the 2019 cycle and pledged to the Wolverines at the opening in Dallas, Texas. The Wolverines are recruiting Johnson primarily at safety, but he is also expected to compete at the Viper position in certain packages as well. A physical, dynamic competitor, the Michigan staff was enamored with Johnson's aggressiveness and a near 4.4 level speed during spring evaluations. The staff offered Johnson earlier this month, and he couldn't contain his excitement to the Michigan insider's Bryce Marich. This is coming from Johnson. He says, quote, "I'm very intrigued with Michigan and can't wait to visit Ann Arbor. Michigan is one of the schools I'm focusing on right now. It's one of the only schools in the country that offers the best of both worlds, and that, of course, being academics and sports." Jim Harbaugh is from Toledo, which is in the same state as Ohio State, which hates the team that Harbaugh coaches. That's about everything you need to know in order to look at this tweet properly. This is coming from reporter Allie Hossfield. She tweeted, "Right now, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur is getting the key to the city of Toledo for being the longest-serving woman in the House of Representatives." This quote is coming from Mayor Wade Kapsukevich. Interesting name. Hard to pronounce, but you get through it okay. He says, "I normally only give this to mediocre college football coaches," talking about also giving a key to Harbaugh. Now, Mazakevich was having a good time among respected neighbors, according to Hossfield, not trying to start a fight. He has a degree from the University of Michigan, but he's an Ohio State fan. Coach Urban Meyer is also from Toledo, and he and Harbaugh were born only a few months apart. That means this is the second time Harbaugh's Toledo key thing has generated more attention than the usual key thing does. The last time around, it really irked the college football team that actually resides in the town. Did not go over so hot. Not with Ohio State fans, who cheekily wondered why their more successful coach, Urban Meyer, remained locked out of his birth city, and not at the University of Toledo, where it did not go unnoticed that similar recognition eluded coach Jason Candle and his reigning Mid-American Conference champions. At least one university trustee sent the mayor a scolding letter. While Toledo President Sharon Gaber may or may not have ended her subscription to the mayor's city newsletter because of it. So a little bit more controversy there from Jim Harbaugh, but hey, what else is new? Camera lighting made beads of sweat emerge from Tony Elliott's forehead as he fielded questions ranging from football philosophy to something he could share about his private life. The Clemson co-offensive coordinator paused, smiled, and couldn't hide his joy about riding an all-terrain vehicle through the woods. The walls broke down as Elliott made a human connection with mock interviewer John Oliver in the best possible preparation he can get for a head coaching job. Now, despite helping the Tigers win a national title, Elliott has never interviewed for a head coaching job. College football as a public entity can't institute a Rooney Rule like the NFL, which compels teams to interview minority candidates for head coaching jobs. So instead of focusing all its efforts on the schools, the NCAA is now putting some of its rising coaching candidates through its Champion Forum to better prepare them for the interview process. It is an effort to increase diversity in the Power 5 conferences and across the country. Quote, "You can't shame people into hiring someone," said Oliver, a former University of Virginia athletics administrator who now works with the Champion Forum. "You can't tell schools what they need to be doing, but what we can do is make sure that the candidates are ready." Minorities make up only 19% of Division I head football coaches, and less across the Power 5 conferences, which are the ACC, the SEC, the Big 10, the Big 12, and the Pac-12. In contrast, 61% of Division I players are minorities. The Champion Forum has helped Penn State's James Franklin, Vanderbilt's Derek Mason, Stanford's David Shaw, Arizona's Kevin Sumlin, and others get jobs with the aim of pushing along the next generation. Elliott, Michigan assistant head coach Hamilton, LSU defensive coordinator Dave Aranda, Florida State defensive coordinator Harlan Barnett, former Michigan State coordinator, South Carolina offensive coordinator Brian McClendon, and Navy offensive coordinator Ivan Jasper are all part of the latest class for the Champion Forum. Picked by their conferences and schools to go through the program, they're all in phase two that includes one-on-one mock interviews, conversations with search firms, and interview or information about contracts and what to expect from being a head coach. Nice to see that the NCAA is taking the initiative here in this issue. On a day in which four home runs sailed out of the park, the game was decided at the plate. Javier Baez stole home to help lead the Chicago Cubs to a 5-2 win and a sweep of the two-game series against the Detroit Tigers yesterday afternoon at Wrigley Field. With a runner on first base, Baez took off for home at the first movement of Tigers starter Francisco Liriano. First baseman John Hicks pivoted and fired the ball to the plate in enough time to nab Baez, but he swam around catcher James McCann's tag to score. It was actually a fantastic play from Baez, contorting his body around the outstretched arm of McCann to avoid the tag and score for the Cubs. The Tigers' best chance to get back into the game came in the seventh. Jose Iglesias led off the inning with a double, but was thrown out at the plate trying to score on Victor Martinez's single. Later in the inning, Jaime Candelario struck out to strand two runners in scoring position. The Tigers open a four-game series against the Texas Rangers tonight at 7:10 p.m. at Comerica Park. Tigers left-hander Matthew Boyd will face Rangers right-hander Giovanni Gallardo. Uruguay striker Edinson Cavani is likely to miss his country's World Cup quarterfinal clash with France on Friday after suffering a calf injury in the victory over Portugal in the round of 16, according to team sources. Cavani missed training for the third consecutive day yesterday while receiving intense treatment on his left leg. The Paris Saint-Germain star, who scored a brace in his team's 2-1 victory over Portugal, was injured in an off-the-ball incident in that match on Saturday and was replaced after 74 minutes. Sources say Girona's Christian Stuani is the top candidate to replace Cavani in the Uruguay starting 11 if he is unable to play. The Uruguay Football Federation announced on Monday that Cavani suffered painful swelling, but not a tear in the calf, which they said increased his chances of being fit to face France. Uruguay have won all of their games in Russia so far, conceding just one goal in four games. The 31-year-old Cavani has been a key figure for La Celeste, scoring three goals in his four World Cup games thus far. That does it for your current sports quick hit headliners. Again, if you'd like to be part of our show and share your thoughts, 517-355-9527 is the number to call. You can also tune in at WKAR.org and listen to our live stream there, or go to my Facebook page and watch our live stream on that as well. A lot to talk about today. Let's get started. Start here today in the NHL with a controversy that's created a lot of stir both in the media and in the NHL recently. Slava Voynov, a former defenseman for the Los Angeles Kings, was arrested in October 2014 on a domestic assault charge. Voynov served time in jail before going back to his native Russia. Now, just to give you some details on the incident, Slava Voynov allegedly told his wife that night during a party in October of 2014 that he, quote, wanted a divorce and there would be no more money for her. And he repeatedly kicked her during an altercation between the couple that led to a felony domestic violence charge against him. The details are part of a Redondo Beach police report on the situation obtained by the LA Times through a public records request. Marta Varlamova, Voynov's wife, told police the couple started arguing during a Halloween party. Voynov removed her costume glasses and stomped on them. Then, outside the venue, he punched her in the left jaw, according to the report. When asked by police what the argument was about, Varlamova, quote, stated that she could not remember, the report said. The dispute continued in the bedroom of the couple's Redondo Beach home, Varlamova told police. Voynov, she said, choked her with both hands three times. Quote, Voynov pushed her to the ground approximately 6 to 7 times with both hands, telling her that he wanted a divorce and to get out, the report said. Varlamova told police that Voynov then kicked her 5 to 6 times while she was on the ground. She said she screamed for him to stop. When she rose, the report said Voynov pushed her into the corner of a flat-screen television mounted on the wall, opening a gash above her left eye. Varlamova said the couple's bedroom was, quote, covered in her own blood. Voynov got scared and the attack stopped, the report said. At Providence Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance, where Varlamova sought treatment, the Redondo Beach officers noted she had bruising, swelling, and a 1.2-inch laceration above her left eye, in addition to red marks and scratches around her neck. She complained of pain to her entire body. The marks appeared to be consistent with her statement regarding the physical altercation that occurred, the report said. A doctor used 8 stitches to close the cut above her eye and ordered a tetanus shot during the 2-hour visit to the hospital. Torrance police officers first responded to the medical center at 11:58 p.m. on October 19th after a call from a nurse. Later in the emergency room lobby, after Redondo Beach police were called, an officer asked Voynov how Varlamova was injured. Voinov stated she hit the edge of the television as she was getting out of bed, the report said. Voinov denied striking and pushing Varlamova into the television. No further questions were asked. Voinov was charged with a misdemeanor count of corporal injury to a spouse before being held in an ICE facility. He pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor charge of corporal injury to a spouse and spent 2 months in jail. Voinov then returned to his native Russia, where he spent the past 3 years in the KHL, before deciding he wanted to return to the NHL for the 2018-2019 season. Those are the facts, ladies and gentlemen. Because the NHL does not have a specific domestic violence policy, the only of North America's four major professional sports leagues without one, the onus is now on Commissioner Gary Bettman to deem that Voinov deserves reinstatement based on his personal meetings with Voinov and the NHL's private investigation into the matter. It remains possible Voinov would face a subsequent suspension, but there has already been reported interest from NHL teams. Let that sink in. There's already been reported interest from NHL teams. These clubs should also know that Varlamova's 7-year-old daughter was reportedly at home at the time of the incident. According to the 911 transcripts obtained by The Athletic, the concerned neighbor said she heard 20 minutes worth of screaming and said there were terrible noises. Quote, "It sounds like a woman is not being treated well," the neighbor told the 911 dispatcher. In the middle of describing the location of the house to the dispatcher, the neighbor stops to say, quote, "Oh my God, she's really screaming." Any club considering trading for or signing Voinov should also consider that Varlamova reportedly told those attending to her injuries that this was not an isolated incident. Now, as I read these things, I can't help but sit back and just shake my head. Not only at Voinov's horrible actions towards his wife, but also at the NHL in general. I mean, with so many domestic disputes coming from other leagues, such as the NFL and the NBA, you really got to stop and wonder what's going through the minds of these NHL executives as they state that they have interest in a character like Voinov. And it's 2018, folks. This is not the 1950s anymore, where it was acceptable in most households for domestic violence to happen, and nothing ever came of it. This is 2018, the year of the Me Too movement in Hollywood, and we're still talking about something as ridiculous as this man trying to work his way back into the NHL. It's disgusting to me on many levels, but again, the thing that irks me the most is that there are NHL teams that actually want this man on their roster. The domestic violence controversy aside, it's clear that this man has not had the time to really change his ways or do any soul searching. I mean, he went back to the KHL and immediately started playing hockey there, and he's played for the past 3 seasons. Now, again, I don't know Voinov, and I haven't spoken to any of the people close to him, so I can't really judge what kind of recovery process that he's gone through, but it seems like if you get out of jail after only 2 months for a case this heinous, and you immediately returned to the world of professional hockey, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of time for soul searching or for personal work in your own life. Jack Kerwin is our engineer for the day, and he's also been following this story closely. Jack, what are your thoughts on this situation that's developing right now in the National Hockey League?
Sure. I think you did a good job, explaining kind of the facts of the case. I'm not as concerned about it as you are, simply because I don't think he'll be reinstated. You know, as you said, the NHL is the only of the four major professional sports leagues that doesn't have a domestic violence policy. So my understanding is every case of domestic violence, it's all done on a case-by-case basis by Gary Bettman, and I don't think he'll be reinstated, nor should he be. So I understand it's a story right now because he's looking to come back to the NHL, but I don't think he'll be reinstated.
And a lot of reports have said that Bettman is not considering reinstating Voinov, but again, it's very concerning when you have NHL executives going around saying that they have interest in a man like this. And just thinking logically about this, even if you were unfazed as an NHL executive by the reports of this domestic violence case, wouldn't you sit there as an owner or as an executive and say, hey, we don't really want this kind of negative publicity for our organization? I mean, that just seems like common sense to me. Again, especially in the age of things like the Me Too movement, where social media is so prevalent and the fans can make their voices heard really at any hour of the day, it just seems logical that you would want to stay as far away from this media fire as you could. But apparently that's not the case. Apparently some NHL executives think his play outweighs his character issues. And it's kind of concerning to me. Again, as I sit here and I read this case over and over again, I can't help but shake my head that we're even sitting here discussing this today. I mean, this should have been one of those things where Voinov says, hey, I have interest in coming back to the NHL. There should have been a strong, unified statement from the owners and the executives that said, no, we don't want you in our league. We don't want someone of your character donning one of our jerseys and representing us to the public in the United States and to the rest of the world. But here we are, still sitting here talking about it. And hopefully Gary Bettman will make the right decision here and not allow Voinov to be reinstated. If this does happen, I've stated before on the show that I'm not a huge NHL fan in general. I think with most professional sports, for my own personal taste, the regular seasons are way too long, with the exception of the NFL. So it's difficult for me to keep my interest up before the postseason, but if this man is reinstated into the NHL, I will vocally boycott the NHL next year and for as many years as he remains in the league. That's all the thoughts I have on that. If you'd like to call in and discuss your thoughts on this situation, 517-355-9527 is the number to call. We're going to take our first break here, and when we come back, we'll look at some more, you know, positive, uplifting things in the world of sports, specifically MSU football and where they stand for the 2018-2019 season. You're listening to Current Sports on WKAR. Welcome back to WKAR's Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley, filling in for Al Martin on this sunny July 5th afternoon. Al, we hope you're having fun on your vacation down in Florida, and we're happy to hold it down for you here in Studio S on Michigan State's campus. We just finished up our conversation about Slava Voinov, the NHL defenseman who's trying to work his way back into the league after a domestic assault charge and conviction back in 2014. Again, if you'd like to call in and give your thoughts, 517-355-9527 is the number to call. But we're going to switch gears here to something a little bit lighter and take a look at the Michigan State 2018-2019 team, and what we can expect from them next season. Now, heading into the 2017 season, there was no choice but to really start fresh for Michigan State. After a very disappointing 3-9 season in 2016, coming off of an appearance, albeit a short appearance, in the college football playoff in 2015, expectations were high for that 2016 season, but locker room troubles and an overall lack of gelling from the team really contributed to that 3-9 year in 2016. Michigan State could be considered an overachiever program under the Mark D'Antonio reign, with three consecutive top six AP finishes from 2013 to 2015, despite having recruiting rankings in the 20s every year. MSU very much qualifies as an overachiever program. But when they fall off a bit, they sometimes lean on older players and older ideas in the hopes of, you know, wringing out a little bit more magic from that team. D'Antonio didn't change his philosophy very much last year, but there were very few experienced players on the roster in 2017, and there was suddenly no success to cling to, again, as the Spartans went 3-9 the previous fall. A wave of players from MSU had either graduated, transferred, or been dismissed, and MSU was pretty much starting over at quarterback, receiver, offensive line, defensive line, and secondary. Now, with their young talent and what looked like a manageable schedule, it wasn't hard to see D'Antonio Spartans challenging for a bowl bid despite all that turnover. And they achieved bowl eligibility 7 games into last season. Now, MSU's teams usually lean on defense and ball control principles, and that's what D'Antonio did to pull off Michigan State's turnaround last year. The offense was mostly stagnant, ranking 92nd overall in offensive efficiency, but the defense was MSU's best since 2013, finishing 4th in defensive S&P and holding 8 opponents to 17 or fewer points throughout the season. They beat Michigan in a monsoon and ended Penn State's title hopes in a game postponed for hours by storms. Maybe it was a little bit of luck, but they faced 2 of the 4 most athletic teams on their schedule in wet conditions, the other 2 being Notre Dame and Ohio State, who beat the Spartans by a combined 86-21. Plus, MSU benefited from 2.3 points per game in turnovers luck. Still, the Spartans' tilt-the-field-and-wait strategy is pretty sound when it comes to winning close games. They were 21-8 in one-possession finishes between 2010 and 2015, and they went 5-1 in such games last fall. And even if they'd only ended up with a 7-6 record last year, that still would have been an impressive reversal from that 2016 season. At the end of the day, Michigan State combined 10 wins with a top 15 AP finish for the 6th time in 8 years, and they enter 2018 with a lineup that now returns more of last year's production than anyone else in the FBS. Plus, despite life in the Big Ten East, which features 4 teams projected 11th or better, including MSU, the 2018 schedule is once again manageable. The Spartans play 7 teams projected 54th or worse, and 3 of the 4 best opponents on their schedule have to come to East Lansing this year. In 2015, Michigan State made the CFP run with a run-first offense that couldn't really run the ball. That year, the Spartans ranked just 73rd in rushing success rate and benefited significantly from quarterback Connor Cook's ability to make big third-down passes. On 3rd and 7 or more, he was 45 for 79 for 766 yards, 6 touchdowns, and just 1 interception. That's a 57% completion rate and a 160.9 passer rating despite a challenging offense. Brian Lewerke wasn't exactly able to replicate that last fall, but despite playing in what remains one of the most QB-unfriendly systems in football, he made his mark. The Spartans ranked just 100th in rushing success rate in 2017, but But thanks to Lewerke, they were 29th in passing down success rate last year. Adjusting for down distance and opponent, Lewerke had a fantastic first season. He completed 59% of his passes, and State finished 17th in passing S&P. He's back, and he gets last year's top four targets back as well. That includes efficiency targets in Felton Davis III, Daryl Stewart Jr., and big play Z receiver Cody White, who actually really surprised a lot of people, including myself, last year. Tight end Matt Sokol is also back, and the Spartans have a load of young receivers such as sophomore Cam Chambers and Lares Nelson, redshirt freshman C.J. Hayes and Emmanuel Flowers, and four-star freshman tight end Trent Gillison. So there's no reason to think that this year's passing game will be any less effective than last year. The main question now is how frequently Lewerke will have to throw on second or third and long. The run game will be pretty familiar, despite some attrition from the running back core. L.J. Scott is back for his senior season, and thanks to shuffling last year, MSU loses all-conference center Brian Allen, but still returns five guys with more than a season's worth of starting experience. Scott had a frustrating year last year. His per-carry average fell from 5.4 yards per carry to 4.5. He had great games against Minnesota and Washington State, where he had 43 combined carries for 304 yards. But he fumbled five times last season. Not exactly what you want from your leading rusher. That likely means he gets to carry as big of a load as he can, again, with all of that attrition, in Madre London transferring and Gerald Holmes graduating. A handful of fewer negative plays would go a long way for L.J. Scott and his NFL prospects. With almost all of a great defense returning, there's no reason to think D'Antonio will task co-coordinators Dave Warner and Jim Ballman with suddenly opening things up. So expect more passing downs conversions. What a job D'Antonio and coordinator Mike Tressel did with the defense last year. MSU came in having lost five of its top 10 linemen, three out of six linebackers, and four out of five defensive backs, all after falling to a surprising 41st in defense the previous year. Now, with this new set of contributors, such as... Such as Kenny Willekes, Joe Bocci, Raekwon Williams, and Mike Panasiuk, the defense should be back at top Spartan capacity, just as we have expected to see from them in the D'Antonio area. Kenny Willekes was very surprising as a walk-on last year. He exploded for 14.5 tackles for loss and seven sacks and took part in 14 run stops, which are stops at or behind the line. Joe Bocci had 8.5 tackles for loss, 3 sacks, and 5 passes defended, and took part in 15 run stuffs. They were both sophomores, as were tackles Raekwon Williams and Mike Panasiuk, who had a combined 8.5 tackles for loss. The top three corners for MSU last season were two sophomores in Justin Lane and Josh Butler, and a freshman in Josiah Scott. Safeties Kari Willis and David Dowell Jr. combined for 5.5 tackles for loss and 14 passes defensed. Now, with so many young contributors and so many big-time contributions, it's really not supposed to work this way for young teams, even ones that recruit well. And while there were some former four-stars worked into this mix, there were plenty of three-star guys, as is D'Antonio's MO. As for who fills the only two holes in the starting lineup, there are some intriguing candidates. Again, they'll be filling the positions of end Demetrius Cooper and strong side linebacker Chris Fry, two fantastic leaders for the defense last year. At the end position, Jacob Panasiuk has had basically the same tackles for loss per tackles ratio as Cooper, but not quite the same ratio of run stuffs. So he's got a little bit of work to do if he wants to catch up to the level Demetrius Cooper was at, but he's right behind him as far as ability and efficiency goes. At linebacker, any of sophomores Antoine Simmons and Brandon Randall, junior Tyreek Thompson, or Byron Bullough should be able to fill Chris Fry's shoes. Now, barring a rash of injuries, there's no reason to assume anything but another top 10 defense from the Michigan State Spartans. On special teams, continuing with that theme of young players, freshman handled the place kicking with Matt Coughlin, kick returning with Connor Hayward, and punt returning with Larice Nelson and Cody White. As with the defense, the young contributors held their own. Coughlin was nearly automatic from under 40 yards and pretty good from beyond 40. Kick returns were efficient, if not particularly explosive for MSU, and junior punter Jake Hartbarger was solid as well. The result was an improvement from 46th to 24th in the special teams rankings. Again, it's not really supposed to work that way if you're a young rebuilding program. Of the four Big Ten East teams projected to finish in the top 11, Ohio State is first in S&P, Penn State is 8th, Michigan 10th, and MSU 11th. The Spartans can probably be trusted the least, simply because they haven't had that long since 2016 when they were a horrible team, just objectively saying that. At this point, you have to figure that 2016 was the blip and not 2017, but it's always possible that there were some low expectation, lightning in a bottle type actions going on last year. On paper, this is another classic team that D'Antonio will field for Michigan State, and they have a chance to do a lot of winning next year. And if they really are a top 11 team, the schedule sets up incredibly well for them. They are marked as at least a 13-point favorite in 9 of their games next season, and getting Ohio State at home means they're not more than a touchdown underdog in any game. They're actually favored in every one of their games next year, except for Ohio State and Penn State, according to a report I read earlier. And the Penn State game is pretty close, but they're playing on the road in that game, so that might have a little bit to do with it. Now, over the last 2 years, Michigan State has dramatically underachieved once and then turned around and dramatically overachieved once. If the Spartans do anything positive this year, there's a chance that it's their 7th 10-win season under Mark D'Antonio. So, Spartan fans, you should feel confident in the team that Michigan State will field this year. Again, more starters returning for MSU than anyone else in the FBS, and Mark D'Antonio seems to have righted the ship after that dreadful 3-9 season in 2016. Jack Kerwin, what are your thoughts after hearing all of those statistics that I just poured onto our listeners? How comfortable do you feel with the Michigan State Spartans football team this coming season?
Very comfortable. You kind of touched on it. I think the two biggest replacements this team's going to have to account for will be center Brian Allen, and it's unclear right now who will take his place, as well as co-defensive coordinator last year, Harlan Barnett, because especially as you spoke, the 3-9 to 10-3 turnaround, a big part of that was Harlan kind of retooling the defense and the scheme that they used. I'm not real thrilled about losing him to Florida State, to be honest with you. I know he was co-defensive coordinators with Mike Tressel, but it'll be interesting to see how Tressel's defense looks compared to Barnett, because my understanding is Barnett was kind of the higher up of the two co-coordinators. Mm-hmm. So those are the only two real question marks for me. I love the production that we're returning. I love all the young players. And I think one really important point about this Spartan team moving into next season is that any more young players who get on the team next year, whether it be Kalon Gervin or Xavier Henderson or, you know, Jordan Reed taking a bigger role, it'll be because they're good enough to play, not out of necessity. You know what I mean? A lot of young guys were thrust into the mix last year out of necessity. That hasn't been the case this year, or it won't be the case this year, excuse me.
Yes, even with all of those young guys taking starting roles again this season, we should feel confident in the amount of snaps that they saw last year and the different kinds of offenses that they saw, that they'll be able to really hold down the fort for this MSU team I'm especially confident in the cornerback and secondary positions for Michigan State. Those guys were fantastic for MSU last year, really surprising a lot of people. And they were able to really turn some heads around the country. That MSU is back on the map as one of the top contenders, at least in the Big Ten in college football. Again, those guys, Justin Lane and Josh Butler, the two sophomores as two of the defensive backs for MSU, and then Josiah Scott, the freshman, were all fantastic for MSU last year. David Dowell actually really surprised me. 14 passes defended. He had a couple of great interceptions throughout the season. Some of them Odell Beckham Jr.-esque, if you ask me. But it's looking good, Spartan fans. It's not looking like we're going to have another drop-off anytime soon. I think a lot of that was due to some lapses in recruiting. And again, a lot of that was due to the locker room chaos that ensued during the 2016 year. And, you know, some of the legal troubles that some of the MSU players got into as well really left a lot of holes in the MSU roster. But D'Antonio and the other coaches seem to have righted the ship, and we should be back on track for, I would say, at least another 10-win season next year, looking at the schedule. We play Utah State to start out the year at home at Spartan Stadium. Then we face Arizona State, who had an intriguing coaching hire in Herm Edwards. So that'll be an interesting game to watch, not only for the Michigan State perspective, but also to see what Edwards is going to be able to do with this Arizona State team that was really up and down last season. I mean, they were at one time one of the top five ranked teams in college football and then kind of sputtered out during the Pac-12 season. So it will be interesting to see what Edwards can do to right that ship. Then we play Indiana on the road and Central Michigan at home. Should be two more wins there. I don't expect us to lose either of those first two games either, although the Arizona State game intrigues me just because of the Herm Edwards hire. We play Northwestern at home after we play Central, and then we travel to Penn State. That's a concerning matchup for me, not only because of the outstanding success that Penn State has had over the past couple of years, but also because sometimes Michigan State likes to, you know, make things interesting on the road and give their fans a heart attack. So that Penn State game is one of the big ones for me. Michigan, honestly, sorry, Michigan fans, but I don't think Jim Harbaugh's focus is really where it should have been after last season, you know, losing a lot of those close rivalry games again. They decided to take a trip to France, which for the players was probably fantastic, but for Jim Harbaugh and his coaching staff, maybe the emphasis should have been less on travel and exploring the world, should have been more on exploring their own playbook and seeing what they can do to get over the hump as far as the rivalry games go. So I think it'll be another exciting game between Michigan and Michigan State this year. But not even as a Michigan State fan, just objectively looking at the players that return to both sides, despite the addition of Shea Patterson, who I think is a fantastic athlete and a fantastic quarterback, I'm not sure Michigan is quite on the same level on both sides of the ball that MSU is at. Then after the Michigan game on October 20th, we'll stay at home to face the Purdue Boilermakers. Again, another one of those teams that has ruffled feathers in the Big Ten over the past couple years. I think Purdue is one of those teams on the up and up in the Big Ten, and I think they'll have an even better overall result than they did last season. But I still don't think they're quite there with some of the other top teams in the Big Ten, so I'm looking at a win there. Facing Maryland on the road, Maryland has had a tough go of it since their entry into the Big Ten Conference for football. So, again, should be another win there for MSU. Then we play Ohio State on November 10th, and that's going to be another one of those big matchups for Michigan State. You could definitely call it the biggest of their regular season slate. Coach Urban Meyer has been something of a thorn in the side of Mark D'Antonio. You know, despite some of the dramatic comebacks that Michigan State has made against Ohio State, I'm still looking at Ohio State as the leader of the Big Ten this year. And to be honest with you, I don't think there's anyone that's really even that close to Ohio State in terms of where they are in not only recruiting, but also in strategy. So that'll be a tough one for Michigan State. Be nice to get the win there, but to be quite honest with you, I don't think it's going to happen for Michigan State this year, even though we are at home for that game.
Hey, that's what they said 2 years ago when Tyler O'Connor and Damian Terry stepped in.
Again, anything could happen. Mark D'Antonio has definitely surprised me before, but as an objective reporter, I'm trying to put my fandom aside for Michigan State and just call it like I see it. I think Ohio State's probably going to take that one again this year, much to my own dismay.
Yeah, I agree. Well, one more thing. Do you really you think Ohio State is way on another level as opposed to Penn State? I thought Penn State had the better program last year.
Don't get me wrong. Kirk Franklin has done some fantastic things with Penn State, but it seems like Urban Meyer is that guy in the Big Ten, such as Nick Saban is in the SEC, where you never bet against Urban Meyer and the Ohio State Buckeyes. So I think Penn State, out of the teams in the East, is closest to Ohio State. Wisconsin might not be so Wisconsin anymore, but they are clearly the favorite in the West, as usually is the case. I think teams like Iowa might stand a chance against Wisconsin, but I think, again, Wisconsin will come out of the West and vie for that Big Ten title for their division. And then, again, anything could happen with those top three teams in the East, which in my opinion are Ohio State, Penn State, and Michigan State in that order. So we'll see how the season shakes out, but just for right now, I think Ohio State is the favorite, even over who I think will win the West in Wisconsin. But you're right, Penn State is definitely closer to overtaking Ohio State than a team like Michigan State or Michigan. So I don't disagree with that statement. And I think in some areas you actually could make the case that Penn State is better than Ohio State, maybe with you know, some of the things like their offensive line or their special teams. But I think Ohio State is still the favorite to come out of the Big Ten this year. Then we close the season after the Ohio State game by going on the road to Nebraska. Scott Frost should actually be able to whip that team into shape. I liked what he did in his last coaching position, and I think it was a great hire for the University of Nebraska to try and turn that program into a successful program as it has been in the past. But just this year, I think Michigan State still got the edge over Scott Frost and the Nebraska Cornhuskers, so we should see a win there for MSU. And then we close out the season on November 24th with Rutgers at home. So just looking over the schedule briefly, I see at least 10 wins for the Spartans, and maybe we'll pull off a couple of big-time upsets against a Penn State or an Ohio State-type team. Spartan fans, Michigan State's right there with the rest of them in the Big Ten and in college football, really. So we can forget about the 2016 season for the most part. Again, there are still a couple of question marks as far as, you know, graduating seniors and who will come in the 2019 class. But D'Antonio and his staff have done a great job recruiting so far to account for some of the losses that we're about to take at big-time positions over the next couple of years. So should D'Antonio remain for the next 5 years, I don't see any more big-time drop-offs, again, barring some kind of locker room controversy or some kind of injury plague that has bugged the Spartans in the past. So feel confident and feel proud of the Michigan State team that we're about to put on the field for next season. We're going to take our second break real quick. When we come back, I'll close the show with Throwback Thursday. You're listening to WKAR's Current Sports. Welcome back to WKAR's Current Sports. We only got a couple minutes left here, so I'm going to get right to it with Throwback Thursday. On this day in sports history, the 1906 Wimbledon Women's Tennis Championship concluded with Dorothy Chambers beating Mae Sutton for her third of seven Wimbledon singles titles. And then actually on this same day in 1907, 1 year later, Mae Sutton took her revenge on Dorothy Chambers by defeating her to win the Wimbledon women's tennis title for singles. In 1914, the MLB's Boston Braves are 15 games back in the NL and then go on to win the World Series 4-0 versus the Philadelphia A's that season. So a fantastic turnaround for that team. In 1915, John Woodruff, an American athlete, was an Olympic gold medal winner. He came from Connorsville, Pennsylvania. Nathan Niles, an American figure skater and tennis player, was born in Boston, Massachusetts on this date in 1886. Fantastic figure skater for the U.S. The Wimbledon men's tennis, Australian Norman Brooks becomes the first non-Englishman and left-hander to win Wimbledon, beating Arthur Gore in 1907. Lots to talk about on tomorrow's show. We hope you'll join us back here on AM 870 and 101.5 FM. My name is Ian Hawley, filling in for Al Martin on WKAR's Current Sports. Again, if you listened in today or you watched one of our live streams, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll be right back here in Studio S on Michigan State's campus tomorrow. Until then, we're on a 23-hour break. Be safe and be easy.